You're good to go, Sharon.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you're coming in from. Grateful that you're here today. My name is Sharon, and I am an alcoholic. In an effort to lessen distractions to others and to respect our speaker, you will not be able to unmute yourself during the meeting. Let's start this meeting with a moment of silence, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Alcoholics Anonymous Preamble. AA is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problems and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. This is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend, but we ask that only alcoholics participate. If you are new to AA or new to the Beacon Group, we strongly recommend home group membership and sponsorship. If you are new or not so new and you're looking for a sponsor, please put your name and number in the chat. If you have worked all 12 steps as outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, have had a spiritual experience, and are willing to sponsor, please also put your name and number in the chat. The chat will remain open during the meeting, except while the speaker is sharing. Also in the chat, you will find an AA quote of the day. The quote source will always be from AA literature. Our speaker will share for 30 minutes on the step of the day, and then we will split into breakout rooms for small group discussions. Each group has a moderator who will divide the time equally and invite each person to share. Questions are encouraged during the sharing part of the meeting. When you share, please be sure your environment is quiet and free of distractions. Breakout room discussions end at 12:54, followed by day counts, announcements, and the Lord's Prayer. I have asked my friend Lee, she may be in the middle of something, to read the 12 steps.
Unmute. Okay. I'm Lee and I'm an alcoholic, and I should be able to say all 12 of these because I've been looking at them for the rest, most of my life here, but I can't see them all the time. So I'm going to use this baby to help me out. And they're going to do all 12 steps. Number one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all the persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Ten, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, we promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And number 10, 12, Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry the message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Thank you, Lee. Really appreciate it. Today we will hear a talk on step one. Please give a warm welcome to Cindy E. from Canada. You can unmute, hon.
All right, there we go. Hi, friends. I'm an alcoholic, and my name is Cindy. And I have been sober since July 17th, 1996. And that gives me chills every time I think about that. I do have a home group here in Ottawa. It's by the book. And I have the honor and privilege of being on both sides of sponsorship. I want to thank Center for asking me to come and participate. To get to do anything for AA is a big deal for me. I really love what Dr. Bob says on why we do these things. And you know, part of it is repaying the debt that was given to me. And I don't think I'm ever going to be able to do that, but I'm going to say yes wherever I can. So my task today is to talk about step one. So step one says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. And you know, for a long time, what I thought that meant was that I was powerless over people, places, and things. And that's not what my big book tells me. It tells me that I'm powerless over alcohol. No, when I think about being powerless over people, places, and things, that's a step three issue for me. That's me trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery. If you guys would just follow your script, life would be fantastic. All would be well with the world. I got the map. Follow me. I know what we're going to do. And the other thing, if I want to say that I'm powerless over people, I find that very dishonest. My sponsor has even called me on it. You know, you just put me in a business meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can change the whole dynamic of that room with a sigh. So to think that I don't have power isn't true. And the other piece about that unmanageability, it's not about the consequences for me, because I've suffered many consequences as a result of my drinking, and that did not stop me from doing it again. So when I talk about step one, it's about what happens when I drink it. I am unable to control the amount I take once I put it in my body, and I seem to be unable to manage the decision whether to drink or not. And that's the powerlessness that we're talking about. You know, I just thought because I came in at 22, I thought I was just ignorant and young and I was weak-willed. And if I could just get a hold of this thing, everything was going to be great. And that's not the, you know, that's not the case. So, you know, when I think about step one, I think of it in terms of three pieces, right? Mind, body, spirit. And I need to treat all three parts of that, just like I need to work all three sides of our triangle. And so I kind of just wanted to talk a little bit about what those three things have looked like. So, you know, when I start with the body piece, right? Like when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know anything about what it meant to be an alcoholic. You know, I thought it was what I saw on TV. I thought it was people who lived in the streets, who drank out of a brown paper bag. Like I really didn't know what it meant to be an alcoholic. And you know, through great sponsorship, I was shown that, you know, my body's just a little bit different from normal folks. And so what happens is, you know, when I take alcohol into my body, it's like every drink I take, I just get more thirsty. My sister can go out and have a great time. She can say she's going to have two. She can manage that decision and she can go home and take care of the family. I can say the same thing, but I cannot follow through because my body is just different. And every time I take that drink kind of takes me wherever it is I'm going to go. And so, you know, I was thinking about it. You know, the doctor's opinion talks about this phenomenon of craving. And, you know, for a long time, I didn't understand that. And, you know, my sponsor would explain it. And I was thinking about it on my way home. I was in Toronto recently. And I was coming home and I, you know, my daughter's boyfriend is allergic to peanuts. When he has peanuts, he goes into anaphylactic shock. You know, life just, it's just not good for him. And, you know, if he was to ingest those peanuts, his mind, no matter how much he doesn't want to go into anaphylactic shock, that's not going to happen. His body's going to take over. And it's the same for booze with me. You know, I can say, oh, I'm going to stop. I'm going to stop. But once I have it in me, I cannot. It's just not been my experience. So, you know, when I think about it, I was really young when I was in the bars. And you know what? I went to have a good time. I went out. I never went out to have two. Okay. I get people say, I'm going out for two. That was not me. Right. I got into the bars first time at 14. I was frequenting them when I was 16, 17, 18. Like that was my life. And so what would happen is I would go out and I'd be like, I'm going out to have a really good time. Now, to the extent of the good time I had, that was not in the plan. I did not say, today's the day. Today's the day when I go into the bar, I get so drunk that I black out for a minute. I get lifted over the shoulder of a bouncer. I get removed from the bar, thrown in the snowbank, and soil myself. That was not the plan when I was getting dressed for the night, but that's what would happen to me. I would start drinking, and then it would just, all bets were off. And, you know, because I had such a great sponsor, I had to find these examples of what it looked like in my life. And I remember her talking about, you know, she said, you know, has there ever been a time where you've been sick? Now, I wasn't someone got sick when I was drinking, but there was on one occasion. I was out drinking in the bar as usual, had way too much to drink, and I needed a little bit of air. So I stepped outside of the bar and ended up being sick in the alleyway. And then I came back in. And my body was saying, you are done, girl, you are done, get in the car, go home. But because that allergy and that phenomenon cream was so strong, I sat back down and I continued to drink. And what I would tell myself is that just, you know, I shouldn't mix those, right? Like that, I'm just making room, you know? And that wasn't the truth. My body was physically saying, stop. You know, there'd be other times where I'd be out and, you know, I would drink so much, I would fall down and they would pick me back up. They would put me back in the chair and I would continue to drink until the bar closed. We ran out and then I eventually passed out. And that was my experience again and again, over and over again. And that's how I began to understand this allergy piece, right? Is to find these examples. Now the big book talks about it really beautifully. You know, our literature describes it really nicely. And in one of the parts, just so you don't think I'm making stuff up, it says, you know, that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, or were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us, but we are sure that our bodies were sickened. And so, you know, I am one of these people that cannot use alcohol safely in any form. And I think it's really important that, you know, if you're an alcoholic and, you know, that you work through that with your sponsor on what any form looks like for you. Now, I might get a little controversial here for a second. I don't know about where you are, but here in Canada, weed is legal now. And so what I'm seeing in the rooms of AA often now is a lot of people are doing the marijuana maintenance program and they're microdosing mushrooms and they stand up and they pick a 6-month chip up. Meanwhile, they were smoking weed in the parking lot. And that is not sober in my books. That is, you know, that is just another way to not safely use alcohol. You know, I had an incident here in my house. So there's a terrible flu going around. My son was sick and I don't take anything at all with booze in it. Cause see, I don't know what's going to trigger this allergy. I don't know what's going to be the one thing that's going to take me up. So my son was sick. I had some cough medicine here and I had a memory of, you know, back in the day when I would run out of booze and I would have nothing else, I would take a couple swigs of that NyQuil. It did exactly what I needed it to do, right? So I can't use it safely in any form. So I don't test the waters. I don't have food cooked in booze. I don't use mouthwash with alcohol. Like I'm very, very careful because I don't know what's going to set it off. And I'm not willing to risk my life on it because it is. I would be risking my life every time because although I've been sober for 27 years, I know I have another drunk in me. I am not oblivious to that. But I don't know if I have another recovery because my pride is one of my biggest character defects. And I believe it would keep me from you. So I have a profound respect for people who relapse and come back because one, you get to remind me that it doesn't get any better. And the other thing is, you know, I don't ever want to forget. And I have such respect for you that you can come back. Right. And that makes me really, really grateful. So, you know, you would think that if, you know, alcohol was my problem, right? My body, just don't drink, right? That's what the doctor was telling me when I was trying to get sober. However, I have this really crazy mind. And my mind will tell me anything to take a drink. Anything. It will convince me. And so I love in the big book, it talks about, it says that the main problem centers in our mind, right? One part of it will say that something happens both bodily and mental sense that makes it virtually impossible for us to stop. These observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. And if you ask me how many times, you know, why did I go back again? Why did I do it again after everything I've suffered? I'll give you a million reasons, but the truth is, I don't know. right? I don't know what that one magic recipe was to make me go back and pick up that drink one more time, right? So, you know, this powerless piece that we talk about, I truly believe that I'm as powerless, actually more powerless today than I was when I walked in these rooms. And I'll tell you why I say that. So of course we all experienced the wonderful pandemic. And so we were all on lockdown, and I, my sponsor lives in Texas. And so the world opened up and I was going to Texas for a retreat. And I had a delay out of Toronto. So I missed my flight in Houston and I needed to land eventually in Austin. So I found myself in the Houston airport. You know, I ran through the airport. I've missed my flight. So I'm a little restless, irritable, and discontent, you know, starting to get a little upset. And I, so I ended up getting the arrangements, got the next flight. My sponsor said, go get something to eat. So I went into the restaurant and I was checking my email. And at the very time that I was checking my email, I got a message saying that I had, invasive ductal carcinoma. So I knew what carcinoma meant, but I didn't understand it fully. And what I would find out very soon is that I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And, I was in complete shock at the moment. And I was sitting in the restaurant and my sponsor said, just get on the plane. We can't do anything about it where you are. Just get on the plane. We're going to be here. And so I got up out of the chair. And as I stepped out into the airport, what ended up happening is, you know, I had that moment, you know, where Bill, it talks about in Bill's story where he's standing in the Mayflower Hotel. And he has that moment where he hears like the clinking of the glasses and the good old times down there. You know, the business deal hasn't gone well. He's been sober 6 months, you know, all of that. And he has a choice. Do I sit down in the bar or do I go and make a phone call? And I had that, just that feeling for a second. And I had this thought that was, I could sit down here right now and no one would ever know. And that's at 25 years sober, right? So I don't ever want to be arrogant enough to say, it's not like I'm going to drink or anything, because the truth is, if I truly understand the fatal nature of my alcoholism, those words should never come out of my mouth. Cause how do you know what you don't know? Right. So, this mental piece that comes up for me is that, I love the stories in the book. I love me some Jim, you know, like Jim is great. Jim is, you know, he's the whiskey and milk guy. That's my kind of guy right there. Right. Like that insane rationalization that, well, clearly it can't hurt me, right? I'm putting it with milk. I'm eating some food. Everything's going to be fine, right? How many times do I do that? My mind still does that to me today. And it'll look something like this. It's a little different with booze, but it's like, I will get up in the morning and I'll go, you know what? Today's the day. I'm not eating no sugar. I'm not going to do it. I'm going to be strict on this diet. I'm going to do good. And I get up and, you know, I do my day and I eat some salad and some vegetables. And somewhere along the day, it's like, well, you know what? I think I've earned myself a little treat. I think I have. And I end up, you know, doing what I said I wasn't going to do. And how many times in my alcoholism did I do that? Every night I would go to bed and say, I'm not going to drink tomorrow. I'm not going to do it. Tomorrow's going to be a new day. It's going to be a new day. I'm not going to do this thing. And I meant it with every fiber of my being. And somewhere along the way, when I got up in the morning and started going along in my day, it was like I changed my mind and said, well, maybe just a little bit. Because you have to remember, I didn't understand the allergy. I didn't know that. I thought I could control this thing. And the truth is that I can't. And I can have all the knowledge in the world. It is not going to keep me sober. I have seen people in these rooms over the years that could quote you anything out of the book. You work with tons of people. They do lots of stuff and yet could not stay sober. And I have seen that. And so if I think that I'm going to be able to see it coming, then I don't understand the insanity piece that it talks about in the book, right? That insanity that precedes the first drink. See, stuff begins to happen. And then slowly but surely, I change my mind, you know, and my friend likes to describe it like smoke under the door, right? It's like, I don't see it. And slowly but slowly, the smoke is filling the room. And next thing I know, my room is filled with smoke and I'm in trouble. And I have been reminded by my sponsor, if I think I'm in trouble, I'm in so much more trouble than I think I'm in, right? Because I can't seem to understand or see the truth about it, right? So that knowledge is not going to keep me sober. So I get that feeling about Jim. Now, I love Fred too. Fred is a great guy too, right? This guy meets up with people in AA. He takes the information. Thanks for the information, fellows. I'll take it from here. Right? He fails to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life. thinks that he's unique and that he's nothing like these guys. I get that kind of thinking. I've been there. I understand that, right? And so, you know, he gets this idea that, you know what, he's clearly different as well. And what ends up happening? He's away on a business trip and he thinks, oh, maybe a little cocktail before dinner. And there sets the train in motion, right? Next thing he knows, he doesn't recall getting on a plane, that his wife is not picking him up at the airport. Like, I get that kind of thinking, right? And so, you know, what I have to understand is the only way that I know to treat that piece, that mental twist, that mental blank spot where alcohol is concerned, is the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because our book says that, you know, in the doctor's opinion, he talks about, you know, if I don't have that psychic change, there's little hope of my recovery, right? So to treat my allergy, I go to meetings of AA. I get into the fellowship. That'll treat the small part of the problem. From my mind, well, I need to use the steps, right? I need to be working those steps so that by the time I get to 12, I have this spiritual awakening, right? These ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once my guiding force, are suddenly cast to one side. So, you know, for me, I need to have some kind of tool in between to get me when those trials and low spots are on, because they're coming. They're always there, right? And so what am I going to use? Now, I've registered hundreds of successes with drinking because I always wanted to get out of right here, right now. And what worked? Take a drink. I'm not mad anymore. I'm not scared anymore. I don't care what you think anymore. You know, I've got great plans and designs. And so I registered many successes. Did I suffer consequences? Yes, I did, but they didn't touch me when the time came. I couldn't bring that to the forefront of my mind when the heat was on, right? So, you know, I have to make sure that I'm really paying attention to what my mind is doing on a day-to-day basis, right? So then there's like one more piece that I kind of really didn't pay attention to a lot, and that's the spiritual malady that we talk about. And later on in the book, in step four, it says that when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. So I have to treat the spiritual malady, and that's the day-to-day stuff. Because in step 10, it talks about I get a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. So what is my spiritual condition today? You know, am I getting up and starting my day with prayer and meditation? Am I watching myself as I walk through the world? Am I dealing with things as I'm stepping on the toes of my fellows and they're retaliating? You know, am I doing those things? Am I practicing these spiritual principles on a day-to-day basis? Am I trying to be of service? You know, and if I'm doing those things, I get a reprieve. But if I'm not, then I slowly find myself back in untreated alcoholism. And the big book gives a beautiful description of that. On page 52, when it talks about the bedevilments. And this is drunk or sober, I have experienced this. And it says, we were having trouble with personal relationships. You bet I do on a day-to-day basis. You know, I'm married to another alcoholic. And sometimes he just doesn't act right. And when he doesn't act right, well, there's hell to pay. And, you know, I had a very situation last week. You know, he did something that upset me. And I was clearly not in the right spiritual condition. I was still doing my daily disciplines, but I was doing it like it was a checkbox, right? Well, I got to get this done. I got to get this done. And I found myself stuck in a spot where one of my character defects became absolutely glaring, and I was unwilling to look at it any differently. And so, of course, you know, what I do is I get honest with my sponsor, and I'm like, well, this is how I showed up. And as soon as I got angry, and I threw that tantrum, the thought came to me, I should call my sponsor. And then the second thought was, oh no, she's going to tell me to do something I don't want to do. And so I didn't call. And I ended up squandering the hours that were worthwhile. You know, it's like I'm drinking the poison hoping you're going to die. And I would waste my time thinking about what you had done and done me wrong. Who's really paying in that scenario? That's me. And so my spirit began to get sick. All those character defects, my pride was getting in the way. I was not going to make this right. I wanted to be right. You know, I didn't want to be understanding and compassionate and forgiving. None of those kind of things. And so I was really stuck in that spot for a couple of days. And my personal relationships were suffering, not just with the person that I was angry with, but anybody who was around me, because I could not be present to you. I couldn't be helpful to you because I was constantly thinking about, well, me, right? And how I had been done wrong, right? So it says we couldn't control our emotional natures. We've got a lot of construction going on here. And we got this really stupid light rail being put down the middle of the highway. And we have two seasons here in Canada, construction and winter. And I am just getting so sick and tired of these lanes. You know, you got to reduce these lanes, right? And so I'm the alcoholic. I'm a rule follower. All right. So I'm driving down the highway. Life is good. And I see a sign, the giant light up arrow way ahead saying, your lane is going to end. You got to move over. So I move over. Well, everybody else seems to be flying up the other side of the thing. And I'm like, I know you can see the arrow too, buddy. Right? Like, I know you do. And so my emotional natures, I can't control my emotional natures. Now I'm yelling at you from inside the car. I'm getting closer. Oh, hell no, I'm not letting you in. You get to wait back there. No, we're not doing this. Right? And so this insanity begins to happen and I'm freaking out in the car. Right? And it's like, what kind of sobriety is that? I can't seem to control my emotional natures. So I think maybe I won't be in the car today. Maybe today we won't go out onto the road and see what craziness is happening out there. So it's day-to-day stuff that happens where I just can't seem to control myself out there, right? It says, we were prey to misery and depression. Oh man, I like to be a victim in my life. I like to be the martyr. And my sponsor likes to remind me, get down off the cross. We need the wood, right? Like you're not a victim in your own life. You know, but I want to think, you know, I'm being done wrong here all the time. And if I keep myself in that place where I am, you know, in misery and depression, it's going to be poor me, poor me, pour me a drink. And that's what happens every time, right? And that's an awful place for me to live in. I don't want to be living in self-pity. I think it's kind of gross. Yet I seem to do it quite often. I usually find myself though more in a self-righteous kind of peace, which is, it's just an angry victim is all that is, right? Like self-pity is like, how could you? And whereas self-righteousness is, how dare you? Right? How dare you do that to me? And I feel like for some reason that justifies it so much better. It then says, we couldn't make a living. Now, that doesn't mean for me that I don't make money, but am I making money to buy that next thing that I think is going to give me that sense of ease and comfort, right? That's going to solve my problem today. Am I using money in one spot to then pay over here, right? Like, am I really living? Am I spending all my time at work neglecting my family? You know, so it's not about can I make the financial stuff? We can all do that. But it's, you know, can I make a true living, you know, or am I, you know, just squandering the time? Because what I've learned being in AA is this program has given me a life beyond my wildest dreams, but it gave me a life to be with my family. And if I'm neglecting my family, what am I doing? And for a long time, I didn't understand that. You know, I was working, I was sponsoring a lot of women. I was really, really busy all the time. And, you know, one time one of my kids said, Mom, do you have to go out again tonight? And I realized it. Like, yes, AA has saved my life. I must do things in order to stay sober, but I cannot have it where my children hate Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't have that. See, because like I said, my husband is also in recovery. And if my children ever need this program, it's not me that's going to carry that message. It's you. And if you are the ones that took me from them, they're not coming to you either. And so I had to really learn how to create balance in my life, which is very hard for an alcoholic like me. So, you know, I need to make sure that I balance out my time between the two, right? It then says, you know, we had a feeling of uselessness. Oh, God, I can do that on any given day. I can feel useless. And it's usually when I'm filled with fear or I'm filled with resentment, where selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my trouble. I'm the only one I'm thinking about, and I can't seem to be of use to the next person that comes my way. But see, my God is so good and so beautiful that every time those trials and low spots come, my phone rings, my phone lights up. And it's always a sponsee that is going through something that I'm either in the middle of or that I've just myself gone through. Right. And that's how beautiful it is. You know, that's how much my God loves me. And I'll give you a great example. So I have two children, and my 22-year-old daughter lives in Toronto. This is her room, but she lives in Toronto now because she went to university and now she's out and she's working. And during the pandemic, she got very, very angry with me, and she wouldn't talk to me. And when I got sick, with cancer, my hope was that she was going to say, you know what, mom, I'm really sorry. All that stuff is happening. You know, how can I be helpful to you? She didn't do that. She didn't do that at all. She said, I'm really sorry. I will pray for you, but I cannot have a relationship with you right now. And my heart was really, really broken. And so I was doing a lot of work. I was doing a lot of inventory. I was listening to the directions of my sponsor. I started sponsoring a newcomer. And as I was going on, I began, my daughter struggles from mental health issues. And in particular, she suffers from borderline personality disorder. And I had no experience with that. I didn't understand it at all. But see, this is how much God loves me. It's the very sponsee newcomer that I had, that I was working with, suffered from the very same mental illness. And she had the tools. And what she got to do for me is she got to show me what it's like for someone that struggles with this. And she taught me that it's not personal. It's not about me. It's got nothing to do with me. And my job is just to suit up and show up just like I would for you. And then I got another sponsee with the exact same thing. And it was fascinating to me. So whatever's going on in my life, I know that God's always got my back. I come to rely on it, right? It says, we were full of fear. Well, you know, what I find interesting about this one is a lot of times I've heard in the rooms, I don't know if you've heard this in the rooms, but some people will say you can't have fear and faith at the same time. I don't believe that's true. That has not been my experience at all. I have had, you know, like I said, I had to then do some surgery. I had to do radiation therapy. I had to do all those things. And I knew that God was right there beside me. It was like he was saying in that hospital bed, he's like, move over, boo. I got you. I'm right here. And I was able to walk hand in hand with that. And what always fascinates me is every time fear comes in my life, I am so quick to turn to prayer. So quick. But you make me mad. Oh, that's the furthest place I'm going, right? It's like I got to figure it out first. I got to will my way through. And so when I'm full of fear, and I'm not treating that with inventory, prayer, and meditation, right? I become spiritually sick again. And then it says we were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real use to other people. And so when I'm unhappy, I can't be of use to you because I'm so busy thinking about me. I'm back inside. What about me? What am I going to lose? What am I going to get? All of that stuff. Thank you. All that stuff, right? And so, you know, I don't want to be in that spot where I can't seem to be of real use to other people, right? So what I have known is that I have these beautiful spiritual tools. I have this toolkit that you placed at my feet. And every time that spiritual malady starts to come in, right? I start to get mad. I start to get angry. I get scared. I hurt people. I have this kit where I can pick it up and I can use it. And I can begin to straighten out spiritually. See, because when I'm in that place, God cannot get in. I got this. I'm running the show. I'll call on you. I know you're busy over there fixing real world problems. I got this one. And nothing can change if I'm the one always running the show. And so these spiritual tools help me to treat that spiritual malady. Because if I don't treat the spiritual malady, that idea in the back of my head will be, well, you know what? If this is what sobriety looks like, I don't want any part of it. And you know what? I'm done with this. And you know what? I've been sober a long time. I'll be fine. And what will happen is I will then, that mental obsession will return. And then I will grab that drink and I do it stone cold sober. And then I'll be off on the races again. Right. And so I don't want to be in that place. So I must treat the spiritual side. When I'm treating the spiritual malady, the mental obsession doesn't return. And then I don't drink. But see, I only get a daily reprieve, right? I have to do every day. I have to do this thing. And what I love about this program is we get one day at a time. Oh, thank God we only get one day at a time. I can do one day at a time, right? And that's how I got through not just the pandemic, but my difficult relationship with my daughter. Just today, I could only focus on today. When I had to deal with my physical health, I did it one day at a time. And when I first got sober, I did my sobriety one day at a time. See, I couldn't look to the future because that was way too scary. And I can't change the past, but I can focus on what I can do today, right? And so, you know, I love the literature that we have. And I have to remember that, you know, in when we talk about that powerlessness, I have to understand how truly powerless I am. I came in AA desperate, as I'm sure many of you have as well. But that desperation only got me so far. And if I don't do what is absolutely necessary, if that desperation doesn't turn into hopelessness for me, I am not going to do what you suggest that I do. And I love the 12 and 12 says, under the lash of alcoholism, we are driven to AA. And only there do we become as willing as the dying can be. See, I need you to hit me with the hopelessness of my alcoholism. I need you to show me how truly powerless I am. It's the one step I have to have 100%. I'm going to build the rest of my recovery on it. And if I've got one more good plan or one more good idea, I'm going to be in trouble, right? And so, you know, I love that. I mean, if you look at our literature, right, the first 164 pages of the big book and the Roman numerals, right, that's our program of AA. Almost a third of that is dedicated solely to step one. So it's kind of important. So I need to kind of pay attention to it. So what I love, though, is I get to a place where it says, have I fully conceded to my innermost self that I am an alcoholic? And a lot of people, what I hear is I hear the word acceptance a lot. And I don't know about you, but I got to be hopeless. I have to surrender. And then I will accept what you have to offer. Right. And so that's what I wanted, you know, when I came in here is I wanted a life that was so much bigger than what I'd had before. And because it was Groundhog Day every day. And today I have a life far better than I could have ever dreamed of. I think really small. And I have to remember that when I think I know what's best for me, because when I get out of the way, God gives me so much more. So if you're new here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I do hope that you come all the way in, sit all the way down, get uncomfortable, and tell your sponsor the truth, because it's the only way that they can help us, right? And if you've been here for a while, longer than me, you know, what I want to say is I pray that you remain teachable, because I need you. You are my example, right? You held the doors open for me, and I need you here. And so thank you so much for letting me come to talk with all of you. And step one is a big one for me. I love it. And thank you for my sobriety.
Thank you. Thank you.